Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit DiscoverSouthCarolina.com.
Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. Joining us on the line now is Dr. James Brennan, one of the UK's leading authorities on the psychological impact of illness on individuals, couples and families. He's worked for many years as a clinical psychologist at the Bristol Oncology Centre and was an honorary senior lecturer in palliative medicine, conducting research into cancer psychology. His new book, Trains of Thought, is a natural history of the mind, exploring how human thinking evolved in the history of our species and how minds develop over a lifetime. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you with us. So I'm interested in the connection, first of all, and your work with psychology and cancer.
Yes, well, for the last, I have to say I retired from the cancer world officially about 10 years ago, but I did work at the Bristol Oncology Centre for about 22 years, seeing lots and lots of patients who are facing obviously very serious illness and the possibility that they were going to die. And of course, that got me rather interested in how we all have to adjust in our lives to fairly catastrophic change. And then more and more I realized that actually it wasn't just catastrophic change. We're changing all the time in our lives. We're constantly having to adapt to change, even on a day-to-day basis. So I became interested in the psychology of that and how we do manage to do that. So that's how that sort of started. And that's the sort of kernel of the book, in a way. It was actually how I began to think about those kind of issues.
Yeah. And with regards to cancer diagnosis, it's not just the patient that has to deal with that information and respond. It's the family and friends a lot of the time as well.
Very true. And in fact, I ended up being a couples therapist as well, effectively, because so many couples were getting themselves into difficulties when one of them got seriously ill and the other one had to be the carer. And, I discovered, of course, and in fact, there's a literature out there about this, that men and women act very differently in the role of carer or patient. And that became a bit of a preoccupation as well. And it's also in the book as well, a discussion of those kind of issues, because women often find it easier to describe their experience, their inner world, their emotions, their feelings, and so on. And men very often struggle with that. They often find it quite difficult. So when those issues do need to be discussed, as they would do when somebody is very seriously ill, then women can sometimes get quite frustrated at the lack of obvious support they're getting from their male partners, whereas I hardly ever heard that from men who could turn to their wives, their sisters, their mothers for that support and so on. So that became an interesting sort of sideline in my work in the cancer world, is doing lots of work with couples and families.
Yeah, and it must make a huge difference having someone like you to talk to in those situations, because there aren't guidebooks, you know, out there to tell you how you need to deal with these kind of situations. There isn't necessarily a right or wrong way of doing it. Everybody has their own way of doing it. Each person, each family, each couple. Yes. It's a lot of it is kind of navigating yourself and seeing what works.
Yes, that's very true. And in fact, that's true in one sense. I was just thinking when you were saying that, that's true for staff who work in oncology and palliative care settings, in a way that I wrote a book 20 years ago called Cancer in Context. And that was very much trying to help staff address some of these issues and provide more psychologically informed healthcare. Because in those days, it was just very medicalized. And I was the only person in the entire building who knew something about mental health and how we feel emotionally in response to these things. So I was very keen to teach staff about how they could employ some psychological techniques as well with their patients.
Oh, definitely.
That's how my first book came about, yeah.
Yeah, it's understanding that when you're as a doctor or a physician, when you're delivering news that isn't that great, you know, understanding that it's not just facts and this is the situation. Yes. You're dealing with people's lives and emotions, and it needs to be done in a thoughtful way.
I agree, Anna Hannah. That's incredibly important, and it's complex, and every individual, as you said earlier on, is completely different and unique, and that needs to be respected as well.
Yeah, it must be important for the doctors to understand the individual that they're dealing with. You know, some could go quiet, some could burst into tears, some might get angry at the information.
Yes, well, it's true, first types of referrals I used to get were from doctors who were very anxious about their patients who they described as being in denial. Mm. And it's interesting because denial is usually not an all or nothing phenomenon. And most people are not wholly in denial. They kind of want to keep that information at bay, if you see what I mean. They want to keep it at bay while they're beginning to process that. And so it's something that just takes time. And, you know, in many ways, a lot of us spend our lives, you know, when we're having to face difficult information, we don't really want to take it 100% immediately. We want to sort of let that gradually titrate that information, so we absorb it more slowly. And that's often how it works. When we adjust to change, we're having to do it in bits, not all at once. It would be too much to try and adjust your mind to catastrophic change immediately. So, you know, we slow it down by using a defense mechanism like denial and so on, or avoidance, if you'd like to call it that.
Yeah. And I think it's very easy for people on the outside who aren't in a tough situation to say, oh, they're in denial, as if, you know,
exactly,
it's a stupid place to be. You know, why don't they come to terms with what's going on? Whereas when you're in that situation, going through something pretty serious, it's not always an easy thing to deal with and own up to and talk about at all.
No, I totally agree. I mean, the other way in which, of course, partners, and particularly men, sometimes respond as well in their own defensive ways is to be, if you like, overly positive, you know, to be, so, well, it'll be all right, you know, it'll be fine, just think positively, as if that's going to somehow solve everything. And of course, it helps if you can be positive in these situations, but in a way, it's of convenience to the person doing the supporting if they can be all very positive, but not necessarily helpful to the person who needs to actually talk and discuss possibilities of the future that may be grim to talk about, but nonetheless they're real and they do need to talk about them.
Yeah.
So that was my first book, and it was very much cancer oriented. I mean, my new book is not. I mean, it does use a few case vignettes drawn from that world of cancer. But it's not ostensibly about cancer. It's much more about how the mind in general works. And, you know, the thing is, Hannah, that we spend our entire life experiencing the world through our minds, but we don't generally think about it. We just take it for granted because it's, if you like, it's the background. It's the obvious that we think in the way we do. So what I'm trying to do is to sort of take that apart a bit and think, how come thinking is so obvious to us? I mean, it's just, we're born with it. Well, we're not born with it, actually. We have to learn to think during the course of our development. But by the time we are thinking, we just don't give it another moment's thought. And I thought that, you know, I've been a psychologist for 45 years, and I don't feel I've ever really read a book which adequately describes how minds work. I mean, there've been lots of books recently on the neurosciences about brains, about consciousness and so on. And of course, I do address some of these issues about how brains work and how consciousness works in the book. But that's not its primary focus. It's much more about what the brain is able to do to create our feelings and our emotions and our motivations and how we change in our lives, how we adjust to change and so forth. So that's much more a focus about how we actually live our lives. So I, I wanted to bridge the gap between both science on the one hand, because it's very science-based, but not too scientific, if you like, but also about how we actually live in the real world. Mm. That's what I want to bridge that gap, if you see what I mean.
And what is the difference between the mind and the brain?
Ah, excellent question. It's one that people assume it's the one and the same. Well, on the one hand, it is one and the same thing, because clearly we don't have minds without brains. So the mind exists within the brain, but it's not the machinery of the brain. It's not the neural pathways, as they say in neuroscience, it's the neural pathways in the brain. It's actually what the information passing within the brain is able to produce in terms of meaning and how we make sense of the world and how we create reality for ourselves. So the easiest analogy to think of is to think of a computer. Well, brains are not, you know, they're not computers, obviously, but they're computational in a sense. They're shifting information around within the brain. So the mind effectively is that information passing through it. So it's a bit more like software is, whereas the brain is a bit more like the hardware of a computer, the actual machinery itself. And another analogy, which I think is actually slightly better, actually, is the difference between digestion and the stomach. Digestion is a process that goes on, but it can only go on within a stomach, if you see what I mean. But the stomach is a thing. It's an actual thing you can examine, whereas digestion is something that is a process that goes over time, as I say, rather as the mind is something that changes over the course of our lives. Yeah. So one chapter in the book is entirely about how that happens, how we're born as babies with very little knowledge of the world or with some basic reflexes, but how we learn throughout our lives to make sense of the world, make sense of the physical world around us, but also the relationships we have with other people and how the world is structured and all that stuff. And that goes on all the way through our lives. We go on learning until we die in different ways.
And how much... Go on. How much control, and does this presumably differ from person to person, how much control do we have over our mind and our thoughts?
How much control? Well, I suppose it feels like we don't have control in as far as we just find ourselves thinking. Mm. I think the one thing I would say about that is that I think people become very, take their thoughts almost too literally, because we can't help the fact that we think of something. But on the other hand, it doesn't make that thing real. Just because we have a thought doesn't make it real. It doesn't say anything about ourselves. It's not a judgment really on who we are as people just because we have a particular thought. But people beat themselves up all the time because they happen to have had a thought, or they imagine the future, for example. They imagine something terrible happening in the future. Now, they don't know that terrible thing is going to happen in the future at all. It's a fantasy. But they can nonetheless feel the emotion as if it were happening right now, by thinking about the future. And in one of the ways that therapists work with patients very often is addressing that kind of mismatch, helping people to recognize that their thoughts are simply thoughts. They're not in any sense real, and that the future will take care of itself. And it may not be anything like what the person may be imagining in the short term. So being able to predict the future, being able to anticipate the future and worry about it is, in one sense, it's a uniquely human quality. Other animals don't worry about the future and they don't regret the past, for example. That is a uniquely human thing. But it doesn't necessarily, it means your brain's working well to be able to do that. To be worrying is in one sense a very healthy thing to be doing, because you can anticipate all sorts of things that might be bad that you could avoid. So that's a good thing. But it doesn't necessarily make your predictions about the world in the future necessarily accurate. Because obviously most of us think all sorts of things about the future that simply don't turn out to be the way we imagine them to be. So it's not a reliable source of information. So we just need to be looking at our thoughts, if you like, in a much more sort of compassionate way, and recognize that they're not necessarily the be-all and end-all, which we can just allow ourselves to be having thoughts without being so critical of ourselves for having them.
Mm. Because so many self-help books, if you break them down and make them as simplistic as possible, it seems to me that a lot of them have. I know this isn't a self-help book, that's not what I'm saying, but a lot of it comes down to controlling the mind, I feel, in a certain way, whether it's allowing yourself to get rid of the noise, not care what other people think, to be more mm-hmm. confident, to yes. All that kind of thing, to be more positive, to get rid of negative thought, whether it's to meditate, all these different kind of things. It's all comes back to the same sort of beginnings.
Yes. Well, I think that's right. In one sense, that's all about allowing our thoughts to be without necessarily becoming consumed by them. And I think that's the problem with things like anxiety problems or depression, is that people begin to believe the things that they find themselves thinking about. And in a sense, meditation, mindfulness are ways that we can detach ourselves from our rabid thinking and allow ourselves to be a bit more present in the moment that we are in, because the moment that we're in is often very rich indeed. And got some lots of interesting things to offer us if we're prepared to, you know, take notice of them.
Mm. And the fact that the book is a natural history of the mind, are you suggesting that our minds have changed over time?
Well, I suppose the assumption is that a lot of people make is that we've always had minds, that human beings have always had minds. And that simply isn't true, because there's a chapter called Genesis in the book, which is looking actually the archaeological history of when thinking, modern thinking, came about. And that was about 50,000 years ago. And before that, if you look at the archaeological record, very little had changed for about a million years. They were using the same hand axe design for about a million years. And then about 50,000 years ago, suddenly we see a big change in the archaeological record, where you have burial mounds and you have jewelry and cave paintings and all sorts of technological innovations that just simply hadn't happened before. There's big population growth and so on. And ever since those 50,000 years ago began, which is known as behavioral modernity in the literature, we've seen this gradual escalation and growth of technology and capacity to think in more complex ways. And, you know, you might say, well, 50,000 years, gosh, that's a long time. Well, it's actually not in the big scheme of things, in terms of our evolutionary history. It's a tiny amount of time. And during that time, we've built everything that we see around us. And I don't know, maybe some of your listeners are, unless you're in nature, put it that way, then look around, you'll see that almost everything you see is made by humans. And they've all been thought up in people's minds over the past 50,000 years to create the modern world that we all inhabit now. We don't think about that, but actually it's an incredibly recent thing. And to some extent, it's accelerating that change, the technological changes we see around us today, and all the extraordinary digital technologies and AI and so forth. It's all happening incredibly fast now. And the question is whether our minds can, in a sense, keep up with that extraordinary change.
Yeah. And one of the other things, quite a big subject, but that you look at in the book, is the different realms of psychology. And, you know, obviously psychology is to do with the mind and the brain. But when you look at individual aspects of psychology, you wouldn't necessarily connect that to the mind and the brain, things like childhood and relationships. And so it's interesting how there's a crossover often.
Yeah, well, we don't probably think a lot of these things. Yes, there's a whole chapter on child development, as I said earlier on. There's actually a whole chapter on memory. I mean, we don't necessarily think about memory a lot either, but we tend to think of our own memories as just being the autobiographical memories of the things that have happened in our lives, things we can remember that happened to us. Well, that's just one form of memory, in fact. There are other forms as well. For example, there's the sort of things we were taught in school, facts and ideas, which we learned that, you know, Paris is the capital of France and so forth, those kind of facts that we imbibe. But one of the more interesting aspects of memory is the things we don't really think about, things that become very quickly automatic. So I would imagine some of the people listening to this program right now, maybe even in their cars, they may be driving and listening to the radio. And when you think about that, well, driving is one of those things that once you've learned to drive, when you start driving, you're doing it very, very deliberately, and you're using a lot of concentration to change the gears and turn that steering wheel and so forth, all those little things you have to do when you drive. But once you've learned to drive, that becomes background. That becomes something you do automatically, such that you can actually listen to a radio program and focus your thoughts on that while you're automatically driving. Well, that automatic driving is actually based on memory. It's called procedural memory. It's the capacity to do things automatically without us giving it another thought. So I would invite people that next time you bathe, you have a shower or bath or brush your teeth or do something like this, these are good examples of that, because you'll probably notice that you do the actions of having a shower or brushing your teeth, whatever you're doing, in exactly the same way pretty well every single night without giving it a moment's thought. You're probably thinking about something completely different, but your body knows what to do, and you just get on with those actions and go through them. And that's known as procedural memory. Now, it's one of the most interesting things, because so much of our lives we are actually doing on automatic pilot and thinking about other things because we've learned how to do those things automatically. Well, that's another aspect of memory, if you like. But there's a whole chapter also on change and how we adjust to change, as we were talking about earlier on. And there's also a whole chapter on therapy, because I've been a therapist for a very long time. And I think it often helps if people have a bit more of an insight into, A, what therapy is, and secondly, some of the issues that we deal with, because they're very, very common. We can all be anxious. We can all be sad at different times. We can even be quite obsessive compulsive sometimes as well. Most people have got a little window in their little island of their lives where they can be a bit obsessive, you know, give a little bit too much time and attention to details which are not that important in the big scheme of things. So it's quite helpful to sort of unpack that and understand why we're doing those things. Mm. So there's a chapter on that and somewhat about the history of therapy and how it's proceeded over the last century or two.
It's such a fascinating one, therapy, because whenever if you're watching a film or a TV series and they're doing someone's playing the part of a therapist, you know, there'll be the classic line, tell me about your childhood, or what was the relationship like with your father, or those kind of things that everybody laughs and sniggers at. But the reality is that most people's issues or most people's behaviours that might be perceived as a bit negative are likely to come from childhood. You know, they come from somewhere. People aren't just the way they are for no particular reason, even if you're unaware of why your behaviours are a certain way. When you start speaking to a therapist and they're asking you the right questions, often it comes back to something that might have happened when you were 8 that has affected the way you behave the rest of your life.
That's true. I mean, we can only be the people we are today because of the things we've learned during the course of our lives. And very often, because we are children and we don't know much about the world, the things we learn then have a huge impression and form, if you like, the templates for our subsequent learning. So we look at everything subsequently through the lens of what we've already learned. So what we learn in childhood is incredibly important. It's why it's given a lot of emphasis. And that's particularly so, I think, in relationships, in terms of what we expect from other people in relationships. That is very often predicated on what we have learned ourselves from the relationships we had in our childhood, which is why therapists so often ask you about those early relationships. And as you said, you know, what relationship do you have with your mother or your father and so forth? It's because if you've had a poor relationship, or it's a very uneven relationship, or an anxious relationship with a caregiver, a parent, then it may well be that you grow up to be very anxious about your relationships with other people, and that you may be seeking reassurance a lot of the time and so forth. I mean, there are lots of different scenarios there, but it's true what you say, that a great deal of how we are as adults is something we've learned along the way, and very often that's learned in our childhoods as well.
Mm. I just want to pick up on something you were saying earlier when you're talking about memory and differentiating it from fact, which is such a fascinating thing. When that comes up, I'm sure it's happened to everybody, when you're recalling something that happened, whether it was a few weeks ago or 30 years ago, And then someone else who was there says, oh, no, that's not what happened. This happened. And you're like, what? No, this happened. And they're saying, no. And suddenly
this
you think,
is why,
have I remembered it wrong? Did I make this up? What's going on?
Well, that's why eyewitness testimony is so problematic, right? Because everybody's looking at the event that occurred through their own lens, through their own way of understanding things based on their own experiences of the world. So, we do, if you like, impose on what we perceive, what we see in the world, what we impose on that, what we expect to be there. And that can be only a reflection of the person we are and the experiences we've had, so that when you see something, you're expecting it to be a certain way, and therefore that's what you see. And that sort of distortion or illusion runs through our lives in one sense. And I do very much address that in the book as well, about how we have natural biases that we've learned along the way. We don't necessarily perceive the world in a particularly objective way, but in our own way. So you're right, that people will have very, very different perspectives on the same event. And the other thing to say about memory, I mean, one of the interesting things is our recollection, as our recall of memory, is that we don't, the fact is that we may have memories that go back a very, very long way. And what's interesting about those is that the research shows that the memory for events often changes over time. You think you're remembering it consistently over time, but actually each time you retell that memory or you rethink that memory or you recall it, you may be in a different situation yourself. You may be in a very different context by when you're actually telling the story or you're telling yourself that story. And that itself, as you recall it, you're changing your own memory of the original event. So each time you're telling it, in one sense, you're modifying the memory itself. And there's quite a lot of research to back that up as well. So it's a fascinating area about how we recall things and how that in the recalling of it distorts the original memory.
Yeah.
That's another fascinating thought.
And I wonder if it makes a difference if you're recalling a good memory or a bad memory as compared to how much it changes over time.
Yes, well, that's true. People generally remember where they were in events, for example. They can often remember that, but they don't. Their actual memory of the emotion is often fairly consistent as well. But yeah, there are quite interesting, intricate differences in how people recall and what they recall, the elements of the recollection. Mm. It's true.
I find it quite sad to realize how much I don't remember. You know, when I look back at my childhood under the age mm-hmm. of 12, let's say, you know, I can picture various people that I went to school with and that I was friends with and various teachers. But in terms of recalling long dramatic stories about things that happened and I sort of struggle with that already, and I'm only in my 40s and I kind of think, well, I want to remember more, you know, it's weird.
Yeah. Well, it is sad, isn't it? Because our memory does drop off. And listen, Hannah, I've got no sympathy. I'm 71, so you can imagine what my memory's like. But but you're right. It is sad. Yeah, I mean, it's worth thinking about how one can actually kind of record those memories, because it's helpful if you can keep diaries and so forth. And what's interesting, there's another little interesting distinction you may be interested in anyway, is the difference between what we call free recall memories. So you're trying to remember an event in your childhood, or maybe a house that you used to live in, say. When you freely try to recall it in your mind, that's quite difficult to do. But if you were to go back to that same house and actually go to it, you would remember all sorts of details you thought you'd forgotten. And that's called recognition memory, which is to say we can recognize a great deal more of our memory when we see it, but we didn't realize we were still remembering it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Whereas trying to freely recall, it's very, very difficult. So it's really interesting. If you go for a long walk, for example, and you try, at the end of the walk, you tell somebody, well, I went there and I went there. It's very difficult to remember quite what you did on this long walk. But if you were to do the walk again, you probably wouldn't have to look at a map or anything. You'd remember it because you'd recognize all these objects along the way, right? There's a lot of recognition going on. It's a very different way of recalling stuff. And so that's recall rather than actually setting down a memory.
Which is why photographs are so important.
And they, smell, photographs, sound, you know, audio thing, they all re-evoke the memory in a very much more vivid way than freely recalling it in our minds.
Yeah.
It's true.
Well, so, it's been lovely to chat with you. Thank you for joining us, James Brennan. If people
want you so
to
much.
Get a copy of your book, Trains of Thought, A Natural History of the Mind, it's available on our website, tre.radio. James, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you so much, Hannah. I really appreciate it. I can tell you it's quite difficult to get a book like this to get any kind of publicity at all. So I'm very grateful to you.
Oh, we've had a nice long chat.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Right.